Welcome everyone to our March Garden Beer for 2025. My name is Andrew Vaccaro and I'm the State Secretary of the Knights of the Southern Cross Victoria. I'm filling in for our usual MC John Smythe, who's feeling unwell, so please give him your prayers. Now we'll start with an Our Father, and along with keeping John in our prayers, there are two friends of God in here who are presently unwell who I'll ask you to keep in our prayers, who have been previous speakers, and that would be Fathers Michael Shadbolt and Father Brendan Lane. So when you say the prayers, you keep it there in mind. So in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. St. Patrick,
pray for us.
In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, everyone, so welcome once again to Bolivia. And I'd like to welcome our guest speaker for tonight. So who is Anna Crone? Anna Crone is a Catholic educator, writer and speaker with a deep passion for theology, philosophy and the Catholic intellectual tradition. She has been involved in the Catholic Adult Education Melbourne, Anima Education, and the John Paul Institute helping individuals and communities engage with the Church's rich teachings on faith, reason, and human dignity. She's also the president of the Catholic Women's League of Victoria and Wagga Wagga. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome our guest speaker for the evening, Mrs. Anna Crone.
It's been rather nice to see some surprising people that I haven't seen for many years, some old comrades, so that's delightful. And also, here tonight, some of my colleagues from the Thomas More Centre, so Gabriel and Daniel are here, and also from Anna Education, although he's out doing his PhD, David Schultz. So some of you might have known David's wonderful courses for Anna Education, and he is coming back. So that's exciting. I heard somebody say who, so there you go. Thank you very much for the invitation, and thank you to the Knights in particular. You're very generous and very constructive, and you just quietly get around and promote good things, and we're very grateful for your presence here tonight. Thank you, all of you. Tonight, it's a great honour to be here on the night of St. Patrick's Day. I'm glad that some of us were able to have Guinness. That's very important. I thought I'd show you an icon of St. Patrick that one doesn't often see. You usually see him with a mitre. But here he's looking probably much more like he looked because he was a slave. He was a slave who was captured by the Romans and escaped and found his vocation to evangelise the then pagan Irish, or mostly pagan Irish. And so I like the fact that this Eastern Orthodox, believe it or not, there's an Eastern Orthodox monastery in Ireland that's doing very well for itself, and I think this icon came from there. So he's still dressed as an Episcopalian, as a bishop, and of course, some of you may know his famous confession, which is Christ before me, Christ behind me, the thoroughly Christological hymn that we sometimes sing. So that's depicted on the scroll that he has there. So St. Patrick prayed for us tonight. He would have known times of solitude as a slave. Minding, there was a trade in slaves in Ireland, so people often traded backwards and forwards as slaves. They were treated as property, and he was part of that. So today I want to also introduce the work that we're doing with the Thomas More Centre. And I guess there's a thing that I can describe it this way. The Thomas More Centre is a formational movement that aims to connect and inform people about what it means to be human, which is something I think St. Thomas More and St. Patrick were doing. in the light of Christian social teaching and tradition. And later on, if you want some flyers or posters about our work, Gabriel and I can help you with some more of that. So I think it's really appropriate that the Knights have asked me to do this tonight. That's our little logo, the tree, and we'll see the tree come back into my talk as well. And I'm saying that one of our goals is to talk about, and this is a phrase from Pope John Paul II, realism rooted in original innocence. In other words, optimistic realism, but realism nonetheless. How do we have a realistic view of what it means to be a human person? All warts and all, but still the term that John Paul uses is original innocence. Has anyone heard of that before, that term? What it means is the way that God created us, the way he wanted us to be able to love freely and give ourselves freely without sin, without the damaging effects of sin before us. And in a sense, that's Christ's mission to bring us back to that in him, to heal us and bring us back to our original mission. And that was part of St. Patrick's mission as well. He could see there were many good things in Ireland amongst the pagans, but they needed Christ. So what a great missionary he was. And probably, how many people here have Irish ancestry? we're still pretty well numbered around here. Or partly, I mean, some of you might be a bit mixed, but certainly the church in Melbourne was built at first by Irish arrivals. And then quickly after that, the Italians, and we're not leaving you, Maltese, and now Indians, and all the other wonderful countries that are coming into Australia to build the church. Thank God for them. How many people have heard the phrase, the theology of the body? It's pretty well known, isn't it? I recently gave a talk to some young people at Campion College and I asked them how many people knew about, they'd heard of it but they didn't really know about it. So I'm going to give you a very quick intro because the idea of original solitude is part of Pope John Paul II's theology of the body. And one way I describe it is after one of my colleagues, Dr. Adam Cooper, called it a big Bible study. So I'm actually calling Theology of the Body an extended rereading of scripture and tradition. Pope John Paul II believed that while people had a bit of a grasp of the Catholic teaching about the human person, about the body, about marriage and family and sexuality, they'd lost the sources for it. They couldn't understand really why the church taught what it did. And so they kind of thought it was just rules, like traffic rules. And you'll often hear people, particularly those in their 70s and 80s, saying, oh, well, the church changed their teaching about meat on Fridays, which it didn't change its teaching, by the way, on meat on Fridays, but it modified the kind of extent of people, you know, if sick people could have. So it loosened up some of the regulations, if you like. But the idea of prayer and fasting has not gone away, folks, even though we're enjoying a feast day today. So I'd say that a good way to understand this is to see that John Paul II said, why are people walking away from the church, and particularly, why are they rejecting the church's teaching about marriage and family and the human person, even more deeply? Why is that happening? And he'd been a bishop in his own, under communism, in Poland, where there was an active attempt to re-educate the population away from Catholicism. Not very unlike our own educational system at the moment. That's a bit cynical, right? But an active ideological atheism, which is not what we have here, we have secularism, which designed to stamp out any religious belief and to get rid of any what would have been seen as traditional Polish morality. So he knew what it was like to have to fight for your faith. Prior to that, of course, the Nazis had occupied Poland. So he realised it was a cultural issue, it was a political issue, it was a spiritual issue. And once again, he was trying to explore what it means to be human. And he called this the science of an adequate anthropology. In other words, what's the right way to describe the human being that's authentic, truthful, and fitting? Who are we? What does it mean to be human and to have a body? What does that mean? And what are we made for? Where are we going? In the corner there, I have a symbol, which is that of the Blessed Trinity. And in a way, that wraps up what John Paul II is trying to get to. The source. Why are we made like this? Because God, the Blessed Trinity, wants us to be part of his community as God. He's the source of love and the goal of love. But there's a lot of road in between, isn't there?
Yes.
A lot of road before we get there. So the theology of the body is a shorthand way of talking about a series of homilies which John Paul II gave in St. Peter's Square between 1979 and 1984, about 189 homilies given every week, apart from when he was recovering from being assassinated.
Almost
assassinated. He was, you know, there was a pretty serious attempt to dispose of him. And what strikes me about his audiences, he wasn't writing it as a book. Why do you think he chose to give it as the papal audience? Does anyone want to guess? Why would he do that? What does it remove if you're trying to give a message and you just give it verbally? Distance. Yes, it removes distance. What else does it remove? People having to read it. It's verbal. It's like a traditional old teaching, which was an encounter between the teacher and listeners. Thirdly, it was here comes everybody. There are great stories of Boy Scouts listening to theology of the body, and it's not easy listening. It's quite deep philosophy. And members of the KGB as well. So there was something very Catholic with a small C about the way he did this. In other words, I'm just going to give it every week. And eventually I'll get through the whole series and everyone will have heard it. So it was quite radical in that sense of trying to appeal to as wide an audience as possible without any filters. He wanted to return to the idea that mystery of our faith is what he called, after a great theologian, a theodrama, a dramatic reel. It's really real. It's a drama. Every morning, our faith is real. It's a drama. Are we going to choose the way of God, or are we going to fight against him? It's a very good way of describing our faith, isn't it? Which way do we go? And he said, well, if it's a drama, where do we go for the script of the drama? And where do you think he goes to find the script about the drama between humanity and God? Where would you go if you wanted to read about the history of humanity and God?
The Bible.
Sorry?
The Bible.
The Bible. That's exactly what he does. The privileged source of the history, the long history of the drama between God trying to reveal himself to humanity and all the silly things that human beings do on the way. They get them wrong. Even the heroes of the Bible in the Old Testament, like King David, take so many missteps, as we know. He said, well, we share that inheritance. It's not just history, it's our story as well. And he was a dramatist and a playwright and a poet. So he drew on all the things that he had studied and loved in order to bring it to make this real. He said, the full picture of the human person is that we are human and we aspire to be good and we're called to be holy. Now, I think that top word is the one that we don't understand, right? You know how many kids I've taught who said, I don't need to go to church, I'm really good? We probably think it ourselves sometimes. I'm pretty good. But holiness is over and above natural goodness. It's a response to grace. And goodness is too for people who don't understand holiness. But that each is a step on the way to being fully human. So how did he do that? He said, let's go back to the beginning. And he uses this idea from the beginning 300 times in his homilies, and the terms he uses is in principio, in the beginning. In the beginning. Why is it good to go back to the beginning?
Reference point.
Sorry?
It's a reference
point. Yeah, it is. And, you know, as Julie Andrews says in The Sound of Music, it's a very good place to start. If you want to find out what a book's about, you read it from the beginning. Or you read the preface. So he says, why do we not go back to the beginning? Why don't we go back to the book of Genesis? In principio. And he says, let's read it again aright. Let's read the Bible aright. Let's read it full. Now, why does he think we should do that, apart from the good ideas? And that is, he says, because precisely it was Jesus himself who says, if we want to understand marriage and family, if we read the Gospels of Matthew chapter 16, in a debate about whether divorce, whether you could put your wife away, Jesus said, it wasn't like that in the beginning. That wasn't as my Father made it. So John Paul says the reason we go back to the beginning, why we go back to Genesis, is because Jesus tells us to. And guess what? We also say in our creed that things were created in the Logos, were made in Christ. And you'll see from some of the icons I'll show you that in a sense all creation was made in the Logos, in Christ. He said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And pretty fundamental, isn't it, to our understanding of the human person. So, the beginning is foundational. And it tells us a great truth about our human identity and about love. In John Paul's understanding, the thread between all his theology of the body is that this is what Jesus Christ revealed to us as the church and to the world. History is permeated by Christ. In other words, history is not just in the past. History is now. Pope Benedict who uses that term, memory is an anamnesis. It's something that represents itself all the way through our history, through the sacraments, through our prayers, through the liturgy. John Paul particularly sees it in these stories, and as we know from St. John's Gospel. Through him, all things were made. And this beautiful icon of the idea of Christ being the logic of creation, Christ being the truth about creation. And I think this icon depicts the Garden of Eden, as it were, Christ's garden. It's a really beautiful idea. So why is theology of the body important? Well, it reminds us that the body is not just stuff. Our bodies are included in God's making us in his image. You know, we say God made us in his own image from the first book of Genesis. God made us in the image of his image and likeness. Traditionally, philosophers have said they're the qualities that we have that are like God. So what are some of the qualities of God that are obvious to us? God being spiritual.
Omnipotence.
Knowledge, love, all-seeing, all-knowing, knowledge, love. But what we often don't include is, why did he choose to make us with knowledge and love in this stuff? Why did he form us in our mother's womb made of flesh? So John Paul says our bodies are sacraments or sacramentals of our souls. In other words, our bodies are knitted together with our souls. That's why the Catholic faith believes that from conception onwards, an unborn child is both a body and a soul. Knitted together in my mother's womb. It's not just made up. It's something that is about the reality of the person. Theology of the body also gives us a fresh look at how Jesus saw his relationship to the Old Testament. He saw himself fulfilling the words of Genesis and the prophets. Okay, so let's have a look at how John Paul does this. Unlike a lot of accounts of moral teaching, John Paul doesn't start with the rules. He starts with the story. And he says, in the second You realise there's two starting points in the book of Genesis, don't you? There's the story about the creation of all the layers of creation. First book, Genesis, called the Eloist or priestly account. There's a second book, and it's like zooming down to earth and seeing it as a garden looks at it. God walks in the cool of the trees, of the shade of the evening. God is more personified in the story. It's more, how would you describe it, poetic. So in that story, God picks up stuff on the ground and makes dirt, picks up dirt, doesn't he? Interestingly, you notice in the New Testament, he also picks up dirt and clay and heals with it. Jesus himself does. Very interesting little sort of, if you like, a typology of healing creation, original creation, healing creation. Jesus does that with the blind man. So, John says, well, the way the second book of Genesis tells us about God's creation is really interesting because it uses human experiences. It tells the story from inside the human heart. And the three original experiences that we can see even before the fall are what he calls original solitude, original unity, the desire for unity, and original nakedness. So today we're going to concentrate on solitude. Let's get drilled down into that. What does he mean? I think this is a shorthand way of looking at what he means. Don't rush past being a person. Because having solitude, I know most mothers, I was just saying to David, who's doing his thesis, he said, I want more original solitude. How many mothers here, how many people are mothers here who would love to have solitude? My mother used to read her novels in the laundry, because she had 11 children and she couldn't find anywhere else to read quietly. So she held the hose of the washing machine so that she could have some peace and quiet. So one of the things you hear us people say is, I can't hear myself think. You need a bit of quiet, don't you, to be able to do that. And we know at the moment we live in a world where you're not even left alone to think your own thoughts because of so many devices. So one of the things about this notion of solitude, it's not a negative thing to start with. It's actually about you being truly having your own inner life. Every person needs that. Why did we go on silent retreats? Why did the early fathers go into the desert? They wanted to taste something of this original solitude. It's not because they hated people. It's a place where we find self-mastery, John Paul says, in some of his other works. In other words, if we really know who we are, we can make some free decisions about ourselves. That's really important too, having the space to be yourself. One of the great challenges of being a teacher in primary school, or a mother or a father, is to know how much space to give your kids, right? How much to let them really be themselves, and how much to say, actually, that's not very good for you. I've got to put some, but you do need to go to bed now. Or you have to stop looking at your phone now, or whatever the difficult saying is. Because looking at your phone all the time means you're often not really giving yourself a chance. You're overstimulated. And also, we know that when we're quiet, in the quiet of our room, we do actually reflect on what we really desire and what really matters to us, what we love. So, how do we own our original solitude? This is a little stained glass window from Chartres Cathedral, a beautiful one, exactly of Genesis 2. See the way God is lovingly moulding Adam's face. It looks like he's giving a dental inspection. I don't think that's it. I think he's actually moulding his face. It's a lovely image, isn't it? Beautiful. And John Paul says, without the deep meaning of a man's original solitude, one cannot understand and correctly interpret the whole situation of man. So it's just God. Here is Jesus Christ creating Adam. But it also could be Jesus healing the blind man, right? It's very similar. So let's unpack Original Solitude. This is a wonderful Blake, totally imaginative painting of Blake breathing over, of God breathing over the waters with his extraordinary wings and creating, or putting into sleep maybe in order to create a world. So right from the moment of his existence, created man finds himself before God as if in search of his own entity. It could be said he's in search of a definition of himself. A contemporary person might say he's in search of his identity. In other words, who am I really? Who am I that's different from anybody else? What makes me unique? And we know that every single human being that ever was is entirely unrepeatable. Every person, even genetic twins, are not the same people. Try the same to twins that they're the same. You'll get a pretty quick answer. They're not the same. They have different souls. They have different minds. They may do a lot of things together. They may be genetically very close to each other. They're not living in the same space. They're not the same people. So he observes this. He says, solitude, there's three parts of solitude that we see in Adam when he's created, and it's true for Eve as well. Solitude as a place of preparation. You know, there's a saying, someone likes their own company. That's actually quite a healthy thing, to be able to sit quietly with yourself and read a book. It's actually a sign that you're quite stable, isn't it? If you're too restless and you go, I can't stand people, you start clinging on to other people. And children have that quality when they're little. Of course, the babies do. But they then discover that they're someone else. And you know what the first word they say when they know that they're someone else? What's the word? No. 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 In other words, mum's saying, do this, no. Hang on, I just said no. That means I'm someone different to my mum. And gradually babies develop a sense of awareness around them. That's why it's so important that children have a really healthy relationship with their mums and dads, or their other carers as well, because that's when they're forming their identity. That's the first thing. Solitude is a place of preparation. It's not just loneliness. It's not loneliness in the way we understand it, but it's about saying, I am unique, I am different. And we see Adam discovering that about himself, doesn't he? Adam says, I am unique. I'm different. Secondly, solitude is about us realizing that we come directly from God's hands. Each one of us has a soul created immediately, the church teaches, by God. We inherit our DNA from our parents, but our inner life, if you like, is created by God directly. And that makes us one-on-one with God, face-to-face with God, before anything else. That's our priority. That's our first relationship. Even if we have no friends at school, even if we break up with our girlfriend, even if our husband dies, we still have this face-to-face vital relationship with God, even when we don't feel it. That's what our faith assures us of. And lastly, solitude reminds us that we have a need, that we're needy. Archbishop Eric Varden says, when we take the ashes at Ash Wednesday, we are saying, we realise that we're needy. We're just made of dust, just like Adam. Out of the dust to dust, ashes to ashes. In a way, we're just a dusty wind. Our lives are that quick and short. And there's a brilliant sculpture, I think it's from Sharp Cathedral, and this is Adam looking over the shoulder of God or Christ as he creates Eve. What do you reckon his face is saying? Wow. It's a brilliant sculpture, isn't it, from the 12th century. Adam leaning forward with his chin, looking over God's shoulder, beautiful image. But that idea of need, I thought I had everything in the garden, I had all the fruit trees, I had this and that. But I didn't have a helper who was like me. And when he says like me, he actually means unlike me. I think it was Cardinal Pell who had the famous saying, didn't he? God didn't create Adam and Steve. He created Adam and Eve. Because, in a sense, men can relate to each other in a different way than men and women relate to each other. So Adam, he didn't create Adam and Steve, he created Adam and Eve, because there's just enough difference to mean that there's a real attraction, a real need. And John Paul says, we can see all of that in the first few lines of Genesis 2. So solitude is, and remember Jesus says, when you pray, go into your own room and shut the door. He means go into your inner life. Be really, go into your inner solitude, if you like. So John Paul says, solitude also signifies our subjectivity, which is where we find our self-knowledge. Man is alone because he's different from the visible world, from the world of living beings. Here's a thing that people often don't think about from the book of Genesis. When God created Adam, by the way, could be man or woman. It's like earth man, Gumby man. He's a bit unformed. People think, well, then he meets Eve. But that's not quite true in the story, is it? Adam actually is given a job description. He gets a job. Do you remember what his job is? Can anyone guess what his jobs were?
Manage
the creation, to be steward of the creation. So what are some of the tasks he had? Till the soil.
And keep it.
Preserve it, sustain it. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? Till it and sustain it. And by the way, you're not the boss. You're a steward. Quite different, isn't it? You've got to be answerable to a boss, don't you? You come back and say, well, in my life, I think of the parable of the talents. So, what did you do? How did you use your gifts? Pretty scary question, actually, isn't it?
Yes.
There's also a couple of other things he was given. He was given cultivation, stewardship. And here's another thing that John Paul II, in his other document on work, pointed out. Work is not a curse. It was a blessing. Because Adam had this before the fall. He was given something to do, to make, before the fall. So work is good. It's how we express ourselves, it's how we beautify the world. And all of us work in some way, even if we're retired. I bet some of you retirees are working harder than you ever did, am I right? Especially those of you in the nights, I think you work pretty hard. Also, he was given the freedom to name the animals. That's a curious job, isn't it? Naming the animals. In other words, God made the animals, but he said, you name them for me. And so we have the wealth of human beings observing animals and trying to get their qualities and describe them. And in a way, that's how language was started, how art was started. Naming the animals, some of those wonderful bird paintings and cave paintings. Beautiful works of men and women who observed herds. Amazing things. And then he was told, you can eat all of the tree of the garden except the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So he had everything in the whole garden except this one thing. And there is a picture of, it looks like a saint, but I think it's actually Adam. It's Adam naming and blessing. He knows he's blessing the lion. It's very beautiful. But our problem is that we didn't like Adam, like us, said, oh, you're holding out on us, God. I'm sure we can find in our own solitude some different ideas about ourselves. And so I think we have then a misunderstanding or a distorting of the way we find our identity. Am I right? So solitude becomes scary and it becomes distorted and depressing. And that's not entirely our fault, but because the world is fallen. Here's an amazing depiction of the expulsion out of Garden of Eden by a Jewish artist. Does anyone know who this is? Someone said it?
Mark Chagall,
who had an insight into scriptural scenes, beautifully. Look at this scene of Eden. There's the angel with the fiery sword. And if you see those flowers, it's like the flowers are being tipped out of Eden. And the animals are all disturbed. and there's curious mythical creatures and little things happening, but there's a disturbance of the universe as it before. So that applies to the outside world as well as the inner world. So now our hearts are broken, and we don't quite understand what to do with our solitude. And here are some of the problems we have with a fallen notion of solitude. First of all, materialism kind of sets us off, doesn't it? We think solitude means that I have to make myself. I don't need God, I've got to make myself. There's all kinds of mistakes that we can make there. In other words, rejecting the gift of who you are and saying, actually, I don't accept who I am, and I will copy someone else, or I'll buy someone else, or I'll pay someone else to make me who I am. I'll use someone else. John Paul II says, that's the opposite of love. However we do it. There are other people who can't be alone for a second. And some people who want to be alone so much they can't relate to others. That's a mistaken view of solitude. Remember, solitude is a preparation for unity, not the reverse. And it also means that, you know, I think I'm the boss. I'm the biggest one. As long as I've got a big ego, I'm the boss. And I'll distort from solitude. But it also means that we become alienated from our bodies as well. So we have to return to the scriptural understanding of solitude as a preparation for love. So sometimes it can seem like a great suffering to be alone and to be lonely. But John Paul II's suggestion is that we see our time as preparation for giving. It's amazing, I bet this happens in the Knights of the Southern Cross, that you guys, when you get involved in helping others, it overcomes loneliness, doesn't it? It gives you a real sense of purpose. And you go out and you meet lonely people, and you bring meaning into their lives. That's a great gift.
Especially our elder members, especially our elder members who are either widowed or in nursing
homes. Yeah, wonderful work. And so what was once your loneliness then becomes a way of bringing about communion with the people that live alone. So one solution to loneliness is to see who else you can give to. And that's the idea of self-gift, even in small ways. Writing letters to someone, thinking of someone's birthday. All those little tiny things in what can be moments of grace. The other thing is not to be afraid of being who you really are. And that takes courage, doesn't it? Sometimes you meet people who want to bully you or push you into being who you're not. And solitude requires that kind of solitude, original solitude, that is finding out who you really are according to God, takes huge courage. It's much easier to read about the latest diet or the latest film star, isn't it? And yet, strangely, those people that are so popular are sometimes the most lonely people of all, because they don't know who their true friends are. They don't know, is that person just after my money? Is that person trying to use me because of what I've got, my talent, my aura, my charisma? So again, even famous people that we might envy don't have it all. They still experience the bad side of solitude. And lastly, loneliness can be caused, I think, because we have disabilities in our body. You know, we might not be able to walk very well or have an illness. And that can be true for people who might have wanted to marry as well. They would love to have a family, but something in their life, they've looked after someone else, or they have an injury or an illness, or they've had some mental illness, and they have this experience of the bad side of solitude. However, again, John Paul II would say, the idea of self-gift and service to God meant you're never alone. You are truly who you are, a son or daughter of God. And a son or daughter of God can bring grace to others and in the process receive a great deal back themselves. But it does mean we sometimes need quiet time. So that's why we have retreats in the church so that we can do that. And we learn to accept who we are as a gift from God and in service of God. So that's the end of my little talk, and now there's time for questions, because I think that's, you're keen to have questions, Andrew, aren't you? So I hope you've got a little bit out of that, and if you want to, any resources about theology of the body, I can certainly give you a bit of a list. Thank you.
Any questions?
Hi, name's Tom. So I have a question about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. How do you convince a woke communist who believes there's 3,922 genders in the divinity, truth, and resurrection of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ? Just here in London.
That's a challenge, isn't it? One of the things I'd say about that is the person who is a communist woke person wanting to believe gender is actually searching for real identity. It's pretty obvious. You're hungry for something, aren't you, there? And so, as John Paul II says, everybody shares in these original experiences. And I've often had the experience of talking to young people who've been a bit confused about their identity. And I said, let's just step back from all the things that you want to do with your life. And let's start with the idea that you're made in the image and likeness of God. So if you say to your communist friend, I believe you're made in the image and likeness of God and you're a son or daughter of God, even if you're not sure what son or daughter means, what does that change about the way I think about you? And I really believe this. All of a sudden, you're not merely a comrade. What are you? This guy's brother or sister. You share the same father. But quite often people who find themselves in this confusing state have come from a place where they haven't had that early relationship with their mother or father. So sometimes that simple explanation can change what they think you're saying to them. Because sometimes I think people think, oh, Christians are just telling me off. But instead of that, they're actually trying to tell you how amazing life really is. So that's one approach, is to say, do you know how amazing this is? At least you give them something to think about. And I think a lot of the ideology that we see today is a kind of quest for identity, which is what we need. We all want to know our identity. So it's understandable that if someone has been beset by ideological education, no parents or their parents don't really love them, or there's some difficulty there, or they've had an addiction, that they would feel confused about their identity. It's understandable. And so sometimes viewing it from that angle can change the way what you convey to the other person. I remember giving a talk about original solitude to a big group, a big parish group, and a young woman who was dressed in army fatigues came up to me. She came from an Asian tradition. And she said to me, I have never heard that I was a son or daughter of God before. Never really thought about it. And as I was growing up, I thought that my culture's view of women was very pink and little and wearing high heels, and I rebelled against that. I wanted to really reach out and have adventures like the boys did, so I joined a gang. And I said, well, the interesting thing in, I think, the Catholic tradition is there's no stereotypes about women. You could be Joan of Arc. You could be Hildegard of Bingen. You could be St. Teresa of Lisieux. But they're all saintly women. And she said, wow, that's given me so much to think about. So, you know, it was quite an encounter. And she found theology of the body really helped her accept that God really had a plan for her too, that God wanted her as a woman of God. It was quite overwhelming to hear her response. So that's why I say sometimes just letting people in on the secret might change them. And some people won't change while they're angry. And that's another thing. You kind of go, well, that's where they're at. Continue to pray for them. Continue to be charitable to them if you can bear it. That's my suggestion.
The Thank you for the talk, and thank you for that answer. That's one of the best answers I've heard to that question today. You said something in the beginning in regards to the reason that we were created in matter in our mother's wombs in relationship to it being a reflection of our soul and the sacramental aspect of it. Can you expand on that?
You know, there's different ways
of interpreting. And you could speak to the mic, just trying to
hear. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, sorry. My mic was taken off. I want to talk about this. I think one of John Paul II's astute observations is to observe that in the second book of Genesis, God actually gets his hands dirty making creation and making the human person. In other words, he unites his breath to the dirt of the soil. In other words, we're made out of the earth. You know, there was that famous book called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. It's not true. C.S. Lewis had a better answer. He said, for earthlings, not just that we come from Earth, we made Earth. And I think that's a great reflection on the blessing that God has given us in incarnating us. Now, we know being in the flesh mostly is a kind of struggle, don't we? You know, I've got big heads, I drag myself up in the morning. And the explanation in the Christian tradition is that's really the result of the fall. But it's still grace. The living in the flesh is still a grace experience. Even if we die young, it's still an amazing miracle that this person with an immortal soul lives in this blessed place. I think it really changes how we think about the earth, too. It's not just stuff. Why I like the Thomas More image of the tree is C.S. Lewis, once again, has a poem in which it's called The Future of Forestry, and I wrote about it last week in our newspaper, which you can go online and see. He says, trees are not quite beasts and not quite men. They have an intriguing inner life. And so seeing, re-enchanting the world a little bit helps us appreciate this being fleshed a bit. So people like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis help us imagine the world as a little bit more sacramental. So that's what I mean when I say John Paul II helps us get back on that journey again. He uses a philosophical and biblical way of doing it. Tolkien uses his capacity for storytelling. And when he has the ants helping the hobbits. The hobbits are us. We're the little folk who nobody imagines can do anything amazing. And they're very earthy characters, aren't they? They love being here tonight. They'd be a bit wilder. They probably would be very hard to stop them talking and dancing on tables. But they enjoy life. And I think what Tolkien is saying there is that be careful that in our advance in modern things, we don't take our feet off the earth. That's what they'd be here to do. Anthony. It's going to be tough.
Thank you. Is it on?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Anna, thank you for a lovely talk and beautiful pictures. Thank you. Just going on a little from that question, it seems, I wonder what you think about this, that God is eternal. He is and was and will be for endless ages, as is said often in the liturgy, for the ages of ages, forever and ever. But like an artist, perhaps, God being pure spirit, the eternal Trinity, three persons in one God, at some stage thought, we will do a new thing, a little bit like an artist. So perhaps somebody who may have been a musician and thought, I'm going to have a go at painting. And so from the Psalms and from the Old Testament, we know that God created other spiritual beings, the angels, other spirits, who don't have bodies. But in the mind of God, there came the idea he made the idea, we are pure spirit, the angels are pure spirits, and they are persons. I know, we know, we'll invent time, and we'll invent space. And in this new medium of time and space, which has never before existed, we will make other spiritual beings who will live forever, but they will be in time and space with bodies and flesh. And I just wonder what you think about that. And then, having had that idea, I'm going to try something in a new medium. So I'm going to invent the new medium, and then I'm going to put spirits into matter. Then, when we made a muck of it, then the eternal word said, I know, I'll become one of them, and I'll have one of them as my mother. So I just wonder whether any of that perhaps throws a light. But it just occurs to me that St. Thomas Aquinas says God is ever generous and giving of himself in love. But one of the things that he gave was he invented time and space and flesh.
Well, what can I say to that? I think that's a very rich way of seeing the incarnation and our own incarnation as well. And to say that it's a delightful new medium, that's something that obviously is delightful. Because remember when God created Adam and Eve, he didn't just say, this is very good. He said, this is good. He said, this is very good. This is delightful. And Chesterton has this idea of God being like a little child who makes a new sunset every day. And he applauds it and claps it and says, let's do it again. Let's just do it again. And never gets tired of making sunsets. It's a beautiful, joyful notion of the goodness of time and space. So I think, yes, it probably is very like an artist. Except no artist has ever actually got inside the artwork and dealt with the difficulties of being the artwork in order to restore not just the artwork but the medium as well. That's another thought. So thanks for the news. It's amazing.
Any other questions?
Does it help people understand? I mean, I think how many people would say loneliness is up in the top 10? Problems that people have.
Yeah,
I think it is, isn't it? It's growing. It's, you know, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of stuff. We own a lot of property, but not finding, being a bit like Adam, getting to that last stage of solitude and realizing I'm actually not in a community that's giving me life. What can we do to help that? What do people think? What are some of the things we could do to help that kind of existential loneliness that has come about because the world is a bit messed up in terms of forming friendships? I think friendship is one of the most underrated forms of community that there is. Because really when you think of, I recently caught up with my two of my friends that I met in grade two, and we are very, very different, we do very different things, but we try to catch up every time we're in the same town. And it's amazing how long friendship lasts. Just accepting the other people and talking through, caring about what happens to them and being there for them. That's one of the most important gifts you can give anybody on the planet. The love of friendship. David.
It's interesting you raise this. It's simply because both my daughters are both my daughters are in, are gay. One, and both of them have been in same-sex relationship. And one of them got very annoyed when I described their relationship as a friendship, because a friendship is apparently something lower than a sexual relationship. And I'm thinking, no, it's wrong. We've upped sexual relationship and devalued friendship.
Yeah. And in the process, people lose interest in sexual relationships as well. They just go, oh, I don't like it anymore. Well, look, it's because you don't understand friendship. You haven't actually tried friendship. Let's try friendship for a start. And really, friendships are the longest lasting relationships you have, apart from mother and child and father and child. And often they're the happier ones too, aren't they? They're the ones that give you joy. True friends are a rare gift. And, I sometimes think when I've gone to funerals and someone says, this is a person who's an amazing friend, I think, really, could there be a greater vocation than being a good friend? We have underestimated and we've over-eroticized friendships. And I think that's why some kids are in those relationships, because they want company and affection. And they think, oh, this is what this is. But actually, what they're hungering for is true friendship in many cases. Do you think that's true? I think, David, it's true that they're hungering for friendship.
Yeah.
And yet, sadly, they've been told, oh, friendship's nothing. C.S. Lewis said, people think of friendship as a vegetarian kind of relationship. The vegetarian option. So a bit tasteless, a bit bland. It's not, but it's not.
Just a 5-second observation. Cicero was not a Christian.
Yeah, he friendship.
Certainly had reason, wrote a little dialogue in which he argued that friendship was the greatest possible human good that we could experience.
Jesus himself says, I came not to call you slaves, but friends. And we probably think, oh, yeah, that's a good error. But it's actually amazing. This is the second person in the Trinity saying that he wants to be our friend. So I think, helping people with friendship. Do people agree, the people that put their hand up about in observing how hard loneliness is, do you think true friendship would be a good start? Mm-hmm. Finding one good friend and finding another one. The good thing about finding one good friend is it leads to another.
Mm-hmm.
Friendship is infectious. And that, again, that's what when we set up Thomas More, we thought, we're not just trying to bring about intellectual content. We're trying to build friends. Daniel's here because he's been a great friend to the Thomas More people, haven't you, Daniel? So,
I'm the best.
Yeah. So, and the same with the knights as well. You build friendships, don't you, as well? As, and you're doing that not by staring at each other, gazing into each other's eyes, right?
By getting involved.
By doing things together. That's what friends do. And it's not just a mutual admiration society. And I think maybe one of the problems we have is a certain inbuilt cultural, I'm not saying a moral, but a cultural narcissism. You keep celebrating yourself all the time, but you can't see the wrong. And it's not, I'm not saying a person is bad or morally wrong, it's just our culture is encouraged.
Thank you for the talk today. Just trying to phrase this way. What do you think the impact of the lack of authentic Catholic education has had on society? The continuous, I think you can call it industrial education complex that we have in our Western society, and how that's impacted this identity problem that you see, because we don't authentically know who we are.
I actually think the idea was about the industrialization of education. In other words, mass producing outcomes and bureaucratizing it as well. And teachers feel it. Teachers are suffering at the moment. Teachers really feel that they're not really doing it. They feel, I just want to get and teach somebody. I don't want to fill in more forms. I have two sisters who are teachers, and I've taught myself, and I know that it's terrible. So I just want to get this out of the way so I can teach. One of the problems with the approach, I think, is you're quite right, because in a proper education system, whether it's homeschooling or independent school, the great thing, you learn friends. And there's a friendship also between the teacher and the student. That's quite special. I don't know if any of you, probably all of us, have got a special teacher that we remember who really changed our lives for us in one way or another. It might have been a woodwork teacher, it might have been a music teacher. Someone who opened up a world for us out of the sheer goodness of the thing they were doing. That's a friendship. That's a great definition of friendship, to do a good for somebody else. And then to share that good, you know, your knowledge with someone. That's a wonderful friendship. And when someone said to me, in the early years of Thomas More, it was first started in 1989, I asked one young woman who's now a consecrated sister, a nun of the Dominican Order. She said, "What I remember was sitting at the feet of these masters who became our friends." I don't know if you can think of a better way of helping people learn. And maybe if we can return to that more personal model of education, bit by bit, we'd see this identity issue start to resolve. Because at least you know, I trust that teacher is my friend, that teacher wants the best for me. I went into a really tough school once, and I said, "Who here?" And the boys were just hanging off the rafters. And I said, "Oh, all right, guys, I want you to be philosophical. Do you know a guy named Aristotle?" "No." I said, "He was an ancient Greek philosopher. And he would have said that you've got to use your mind. So I'm going to ask you to use your mind." And I went, "What do you mean?" I said, "Okay, who, listen to my question, who here doesn't want to find true love?" "What?" I said, "That's the question. Don't rush it. Think about it carefully." There was a stunned silence. And one of the boys in the back goes, "Miss, everybody wants true love." I said, "Just leave it. Don't answer for everybody." But what was happening there was a recognition that there's something that's so universal, really, deeply. That's where you start a conversation, can't we? When you get to that point that you say, and I let them think, I sort of strung them along, "No, no, don't rush the answer. Come on, I really want you to think about it." And they actually were very quiet. And they asked, we started to look at what does true love in friendship terms mean. And it was, they gave some great answers. So I got around that being a tough guy, showing off, ADHD, crazy. The boys had recently had a knife fight the day before, and I might say, too, that was encouraging. But they, underneath it all, they actually were able to quiet down again and find a little bit of their own thought. And I think maybe that's another thing we can contribute, is really encouraging kids upwards rather than just levelling them down all the time. So there are two things. Friendship between teachers, fine teachers and students, and also this idea of just raising people up.
One more question.
Hello, Alan. Thank you for the talk. My name's Michael. Just wondering, has there been moves to try and use the theology of the body like in secondary education at all? Or is it a bit,
it's not quiet? It has been. I mean, there have been, especially in America, there have been people who've made whole professions out of, you know, someone like Christopher West or Jason Emmett. Jason Emmett came to Australia, but the schools rejected him. Unbelievable. He's too effective, yeah. And there's in America there have been people who haven't, I believe there are a couple of groups of people in Australia who've tried to get into schools. I went into a school once to give a talk about something and they said, "Oh, I wish we could have more of it, but the curriculum is so packed." So it would really take an overhaul of the curriculum in secondary school, I think, to realise this is important, David.
I think the problem is deeper than that. The gender issue.
Yeah.
Has been completely hook, line and sinker swallowed in the schools.
Yeah.
And not just in the students, but the teachers are now of that generation where the body is no longer thought of as a gift. And so theology of the body hasn't got a snowflake's chance in Hades because already you're using the terms male and female.
One friend of mine goes into schools to talk about the dangers of porn and how people get off it. Dressed the classroom and she said, "Now, girls." And she was told she wasn't allowed to say it. It was a girls' school. And so a sign up the front saying, "Christian girls' school, it is a Christian girls' school." And she was told she wasn't allowed to come in again because she used, she said, you have to call them students. She said, well, I sometimes do use this phrase, students, but they are girls, or women, or ladies, or... So if you're calling your own college a girls' college, we're starting to get to the sort of naming. And I think you're right, Dave, what originally was a bureaucratized education is now the ideological problem of schools, where they're afraid that people will commit suicide. But then, of course, we've got the problem of kids who want to be furries as well. They want to be cats or dogs. And so the trouble with that identity thing, when you base it purely on your own imagination, you can never be satisfied because it's not... Remember I talked about realism. Your own imagination, if it's a little bit disturbed or you've got an emotional challenge, will never be satisfied with the identity quest.
Can I have a two bucks worth here?
Yeah.
Everything about the theology of the body, as you're saying, is accepting the body as the gift from God.
Yes.
And as the starting point of your identity. Mm. If your body is not the starting point of who you are as a unique individual, some idea is. And it's interesting, as soon as we reject our body, then we are looking for an idea of male and female. Like you said a moment ago, Joan of Arc, Hildegard of Bingen, St. Teresa, all of these
women
were women differently, mm-hmm. and in their own way, they weren't working with an idea of what it meant to be a woman. They were just being who they were in their bodies. But as soon as your body goes, then you've got an idea of what male is and what female is. So I say, I'm a male inside a female's, or I'm a female inside a male's body, because I've got an idea of what feminine is. And so society is determining it, not my body. And in a sense, you become a prisoner of the ideology,
yeah.
rather than free within your own body.
There's a great children's author called Alberg. Has anyone seen her book? She wrote a book for great children. She's called one The Body I'm In. It's a little children's book. It's lovely because it's about a little kid who's going, oh, I don't feel quite right. And the kids say, well, actually, you are who you are. So it's actually, but her books have been banned. She's actually one of the most famous children authors. But if you want the book, you have to go to the brown paper wrapper and ask for a pound of candy. So this is the craziness we're in. I think, though, people are starting to turn against crazy. I think people are starting to say, this doesn't ring true. And people are made to seek the truth. Just as our people had to live under that kind of grey communism in Poland for years, and they had to keep saying to themselves, this is not true. This is not true. Or Nazis, this is, why is there resistance? This is not true. So I think eventually those who are convinced of the truth and can do this with charity, and I think charity is important here, I think that things will change. And I think they are changing. I think people are starting to say, hang on, that doesn't make true. You're saying all these words, but they don't make sense. They don't help people, and people, especially if you ever hear any of the young people who are de-transitioning, they are some of the most powerful voices about reality. One young woman, Vanessa Bell, is that her name? Vanessa Bell. She was the reason that England banned using puberty blockers. And she said, no one ever challenged my thinking. My thinking was messed up. But no one challenged my thinking. At half-hour interviews, I was betrayed by the medical system and the educational system. What does a teacher do? Challenge the thinking. So her voice is very powerful.
Yeah. One last comment on that. I think it's basically a new form of Gnosticism, which is, you know, the matter is evil and our spirit is devoid from matter. And I don't know about it enough about it, how it was dealt with back in the early centuries, but maybe that's a mine, something to mine in that. How did, you know, we recover from Gnosticism?
Well, Sir Francis is a Dominic for one group who said, this is not true. I suspect Sir Patrick had to overcome a certain sort of power in Gnosticism of, say, the Druids. I'm sure that, you know, I think Christianity is a faith of realism. And so it's constant because it believes in the goodness of creation, even to the point of having sacraments that are made of stuff. So I think you're right. I think we could look at the... I think historians are very important here. I agree with that. I think looking at their response, so in the case of the Cathars, who believe they're all magical as evil. And so the very first converts to the Dominican order were women who'd been Cathars and saw how liberating it was to actually celebrate the fact that they were, as David says, born in their women's body, and they could pray in them. And there's some lovely letters between the early Dominicans and Blessed Diana, who writes, you know, about feeling the pain of her brother Dominican's knee. How is the pain in your knee? I'm feeling the pain in your knee. So that going from matter is nothing to going to I'm here with you. It's great. It's a great conversion story.
Well, thank you very much, Anna, for having us be here tonight. Thank you very much for coming. Could we please give Anna a round of applause? Now, God and Mia functions through the generous donations of the attendees that are here tonight. So if you're able to, I'll pass on some buckets. If you're able to make a donation, please do so and pass them on. As mentioned before, God and Mia is a project of the Knights of the Southern Cross Victoria. We're an organisation of Catholic men who serve the Catholic Church through various means, spiritual, through charitable works, fundraising, etc. And as Anne said, it's a great way for people to get together and get to know one another, form great friendships, lifelong friendships in many cases. If any gentleman's interested in finding out more about the Knights, you can see me at the end of this meeting. There are a number of our members here also that you might want to talk to. Our next God and Mia event is Monday, April the 14th, and it's topic is spiritual warfare, and our guest speaker is Rob Zarr. So once again, they'll be here on Monday, April the 14th. One of our major sponsors is the Catholic Development Fund. So they help support the work that we do here at God and Mia. They currently have offers on various term deposits. So if you're interested in placing your money in a place which helps the Catholic Church as well as getting an investment, go to the CDF website and you can find out more. I'd also like to promote a great Melbourne tradition this Lenten season. Many of you have probably heard of the annual Melbourne Passion Play. It's been going on for over 25 years. Its traditional homeland has been in the eastern suburbs, Doncaster and Templestowe. This year, there's a change of location. So for those of you who might have ventured all the way out from the west, we're finally going to address the needs of having a passion play out in the west. This year's location for the Melbourne Passion Play is at Catholic Regional College, Sydenham. So it's quite a way distance from its original location in Doncaster and Templestowe. I happen to be the videographer for the last two Passion Plays and will be doing so again this year. We are seeking volunteers to act as well, playing the people or Roman soldiers and there might still be other main roles that need to be filled. So if anyone is interested, come and see me and I can give you some details. But our performances will be on Palm Sunday, I think it's about 12:30, 1 o'clock, and then Good Friday, I believe it's about 10 o'clock. So for those of you who have never seen the Passion Play, and particularly for those of you who are out in the western suburbs, now is your year. So we'd really love to come and see you there. And you can get God and Beer on our social media page. So the video of this will be available in coming days on my YouTube channel. You can also get updates and, you know, all the information on the Facebook page. It's the main place to get the information. For those of you on Twitter, I share these on my Twitter page as well. And we're also on podcast format, so if you find listening on MP3 or while you're driving your car or whatever, on Bluetooth, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and RSS. So thank you very much, everyone. I hope you've had a great evening, and we'll see you next month. Thank you.